Hey, this is Vince Easley. I'm doing a special broadcast here. You probably come in stages. A lot to read here. This is an Ozark Heritage. It's a family history of George and Ida Barnett. It includes surnames of Grinder, Torex, Lowrance, Guffey, Clements, and other surnames. This is a second edition from January 2005. And the first edition was June of 1999. Compiled by Irma Stevenson. This book may be reproduced without permission of the author. However, please give credit to the sources. Page 1. Page 2 is about the cover pictures. The watercolor picture on the front cover was created from the photo below of Maddie and Ida doing the laundry on the Gentry, Arkansas farm in the 1930s. The cover was painted and designed by Greg Page, who is the son of Leola and Frank Page. Leola was the daughter of Ola Lowrance McFarlane, and Ola was the daughter of Nancy Melissa Guffey and John Bell Lowrance. Greg's participation in the creative arts of visual and music began in elementary school and continues to the present day. He has had a solo exhibitions of his work at the American Cultural Arts Center in Irvine Fine Arts Center and the Northgate Gallery. His music has appeared on film projects and recently been utilized on Sony PlayStation soundtracks. Greg held the office of Vice President of the Anaheim Art Association from 1988 to 1990 and recently worked within the National Association of Music Merchants exposition as a clinical a clinician for Roland International. The picture on the back cover is copied from an old photo probably taken by Ida. It is of the tracks at Horseshoe Bend through which the MNA, that's the Missouri and North Arkansas Railroad, wound its way to and from, Elba around here, but it's spelled Elba, Arkansas. The front cover represents Ida's work in the home industries. The back cover represents George's work. The railroad tracks made with the hand-hewn and hand-stacked ties and the surrounding corn fields where he farmed. The forward is page 3. Say what? Yes, I know you're probably thinking, what is so important about genealogy? So I asked the one so what question for you. I have some answers, though. They are my answers, and you may have or find others as you read. None of these genealogical facts change who we are as individuals, but it helps confirm our individuality from kings and paupers, from martyrs and preachers. We have inherited life. Can you imagine that out of all these ancestors and events, we came to be? What are the odds? It is a chance to praise God for our individuality and who we are. It gives meaning to history. Some say that genealogy is history under a microscope because it was our ancestors who crossed the ocean, fought for freedom, we enjoyed and followed the trails westward. It was our ancestors who gave us this rich inheritance, and it is our privilege not only to pass this heritage on, but to add even more depth and meaning to it by our lives. It is an answer book for your children's questions or your friends' questions like, where did you and your name come from? It's a place to begin if the genealogy bug should ever bite you. There is much more research to be done, and if you would like to work with me, her, on this, please give me a call. Maybe you can publish the next edition for us. If you are into society events, this work may provide evidence qualifying you to join SDAR. That's the Sons and Daughters of the American Revolution. Of course, you would have to finish additional proof to, you'd have to provide, no, I'm sorry, or you Of course, you would have to furnish additional proof to qualify, but that would require minimal additional research. Well, we've got me and my brother's, well, he mostly has compiled a pretty good ancestry of the Easley family. Excuse me. Continue. My prayers go with this book to you. My hope is that God will help you see yourself as a part of His plan as you reflect on how you came to be. It is still true that we have nothing to fear for the future, except we forget the way God has led us in the past. According to the information available from family members, genealogy, libraries, state and national historic societies, and many other sources, I have attempted to record accurate facts of the history of the George and Ida Barnett family. However, the careful reader will find some conflicting dates and events. My purpose for including such information is not to blur the past, but to present the best available information. She found it even though it may be inconsistent. You're free to copy this genealogy as you like, but please give credit to the sources. Enjoy. If you find information, she'd love to know about it, and this will allow her to update her files for future reference. Please contact Emma Stevenson, 2434 Percheron Court, Southeast in Salem, Oregon, 97301. You can email her at irmajane@mailaka.net. Her cell phone number is 503-991-1873. If these are good numbers still, this is a book put out a while back. On page 4 we have thanks. I've always seen books that say, thanks to so-and-so for putting up with me while I wrote the book. Now I know why. My family appreciate this also, as they have put up with me and my hobby for quite some time now. Thanks, Doyle, Andrew, Sheila, and Michelle. Aren't you glad it's finally done? Again. Thanks to Dora Stevenson, whose stories inspired me to put them on paper. Thanks to Uncle Ray Barnett for helping me find books and people to help with the project. Thanks to Sharon O'Rio, I-O-R-I-O, Ola McFarlane and her daughters, and Leola Mae McFarlane Page, and to Janelle Kersey for their help with the Guffey and Lowrance lines. Thanks to Don Barnett and the Barnett Banner, who has provided many connections in the Barnett line. Thanks to a newfound cousin, James E. Hargraves, for his invaluable help on the grinder lines. Thanks to Greg for the water color picture, gracing the cover and capturing the colors of our Ozark roots. Thanks to each of you who shared your bits of knowledge and your pictures. Thanks to each of you who have said, I'm glad you're doing this. Thanks to Ida Barnett, who loved and respected for her wit and her ability to think. I was never privileged to meet George Barnett and many of the others whose stories I've recorded, but they have left a rich heritage for us. May their memories live on in our hearts and minds and continue to challenge us to face life with ever more courage and hope and industriousness. And I wish to thank my husband, she says, Doyle, for getting excited about this second edition and helping get it back into print. Now one final thanks to God above, who inspired these ancestors to live lives of courage and faith. The second edition. This book was originally published in the summer of 1999. Ooh, Great Daddy Long Legs coming up on me. Oh, back to where I was at. I'll start again. The book was originally published in the summer of 1999, just prior to the Barnett family reunion in Bend, Oregon, and was originally distributed at that time. All 75 books were eventually sold, and additional copies have been requested. Hence, this book is being updated and reproduced in 2005. Errors identified in the first edition have been corrected, and new bits and pieces have been included. In addition, a chapter has been added called Elba Then and Now. Now, Elba's just down the off the mountain from me below. I could hit the river going in three directions here where I'm at, but Elba's off down to the left and kind of forward ahead from me. Anyways, that's a little side information. You're on Half Moon Mountain. Okay, so that additional chapter of Elby, spelled Elba, Elby, Then and Now, which presents some of the history of the area, the area since the 1920s. We wish to thank the Ormond family, and especially Haley Grissom, for their helpfulness in providing this information. In the Grinder chapter, several pages have been added about the Cherokee heritage from Tennessee and the Ozarks. Iva Barnett's biography has been expanded to Irvy Barnett's biography has been updated to include a little about his service during World War II. Many maps and pictures have been added, including a section on reunions. The ancestry tree has been expanded to include Ida's ancestry, or her ancestors, who signed the Magna Carta in 1215. I've tried to organize the second version better by including picture pages in the numbering of the pages. Known changes to births and deaths have also been made. How to follow through this contents through the contents of this book. Chapter 1 of the book begins with a sketch of the lives of George and Ida Barnett. Elby Then and Now describes Elby in the early days and how it's being restored. A biographical sketch of each of the four parents of George and Ida follows in chapters 3 through 6. Each genealogical line is traced backwards until research is stopped, either because of lack of information or lack of time and resources to do more research. The names of the ancestors and George and Ida Barnett have been typed in bold to make it easier for family to follow their genealogical line back. The book ends with a chapter sketching the lives of each of the children of George and Ida Barnett, and a list of their descendants, reunions, and a family tree complete the book. Dedication. This book is dedicated to the memory of George and Ida Barnett, who taught and lived family values. There's a picture here of George and Ida on their 50th wedding anniversary, that being from July the 24th in 1910 to 1960. It was taken at their home in Gentry, Arkansas. The table of contents are title page, about the cover, forward, thanks, dedication, contents. Chapter 1, George and Ida Barnett. We have George's boyhood, Ida's childhood days, George and Ida's marriage and first children, beliefs and experiences, Elba and school days, Elby. Medicine and cures, of eating and surviving off the land, the flood, prosperity and the Missouri and North Arkansas Railroad, the move, birth of the twins and other changes, later years, a tribute to our parents, is at page 59. Beginning chapter 2, Elby Then and Now, Ode to Elby. Haley Ormond, Arthur Ormond, Haley D. Grissom, Elba Today, Elby, Ole Lowrance McFarlane, Reminiscing Childhood Days in Elby. Chapter 3, The Barnett Line, Robert Martin Barnett, David Barnett of Searcy County, Homesteads, Traditional Family History, Testimony of Peter Tyler, Barnett and Henley feud. On page 121, continuing, James Lemuel Barnett, David Barnett Sr., the parents of David Barnett, origins of the Barnett name. There was a question in chat on that. That has come to on page 130. Known descendants of David Barnett Sr., and what was it like in 1900? Boy, this is going to be a lot of interesting stories and reading, I think, in this. We get to chapter 4 of the Grinder Line, and we have Samuel, John, Joshua, John again, and then to the Grinder Origins. Peter Torex and Elizabeth M. Jones, Solomon Jones, Isaac Burnham, Benjamin Burnham, Captain Gabriel Burnham, and Gabriel Burnham, George Young, a traditional story, the legend of Mariah Jones and William Buchanan, proof the Cherokee Nation and known descendants of John Grinder. Chapter 5 is the Lowrance line, and I know some Lowrances around here still. We have John Bell Lowrance, Nancy Melissa Guffey. We got Homestead, Foods, School and Church, Events Worth Remembering, Nancy, John, The Move, Alphys Lowrance, Isaac Lowrance, Abraham, Peter, Alexander, Johannes, Thomas Swan. Those were Lowrances. Then we come to Thomas Swan and known descendants of Johannes Lowrance. That's page 235. Turn the page to chapter 6. McGuffey line. We have Elijah Morrison Guffey and Mary Catherine Higdon. Thomas Franklin Guffey. John Thomas Guffey. Henry Guffey. Cornelius Clements. Abraham Clements. Miles Goforth. That's a good name. Goforth. George Goforth. Zachariah Goforth. William Goforth. Or Willoughby. Skip with, huh? I know some Willoughbys, but to skip with, is that a, maybe that's a different meaning there. Willoughby skip with, that'd be interesting. That comes up at page 258. The 25 sureties of the Magna Carta. Well, that would be very interesting. That's on 250, page 259. And then we come to close out that chapter of known descendants of Henry Guffey. Final chapter is chapter 7. It's descendants of George and Ida. We have Ida Barnett, Irvy Barnett, Dora Barnett, Doyle Barnett, Ray Barnett, Geneva Barnett, Jeanette Barnett, cousins and reunions. Then to the appendix, the ancestry tree, George Barnett's ancestry tree, and Ida Lowrance's ancestry tree. Chapter 1 is George and Ida Barnett. This is on page 10. Chapter 1, George and Ida. George Jackson Barnett and Ida Jane Lowrance. George, let's just pause a sec. Chapter 1, George and Ida. George Jackson Barnett was born September 11, 1885, near St. Joe, in Searcy County, Arkansas. The area is located in the Ozark Mountains near the Buffalo River and a usually empty creek bed that is called Dry Creek. George was the firstborn son of Robert Martin Barnett and Mary Elizabeth Grinder, who we know as Betty. George was probably named for his mother's brother, George Grinder, or maybe his mother's father, George Peter Torex. His middle name, Jackson, probably came from the Barnett side of the family. Four brothers, John, Albert, James, Monroe, Samuel David, and Abraham, joined the family after George arrived. In the fall of 1895, when George was only 10 years old and Abraham was a mere 5 or 6 months old, their mother, Betty, is said to have died of remittent fever. Remittent fever is also known as typhoid fever. George also had remittent fever, but was not so ill. However, there was a year in his life he could not remember. In 1893, at age 8, George was farmed out to work for $5 a month to help support the family. This was not unusual in his day, but as a result, he never learned to read or write, since his job prevented him from attending school. George always felt that he had to work harder and be more frugal, perhaps, than others to make up for this handicap. So much so that later on, he was very concerned about being able to provide for a wife and children. George's dad remarried in the spring of 1898 to Susie Torix. She was said to be part Indian, probably of the Cherokee tribe. Robert's family objected strongly to this marriage, so eventually Robert moved his family to Elby. It's Elba, Arkansas, in Van Buren County, which is about 40 miles away. Elba lay between the present-day towns of Leslie and Shirley. Robert soon homesteaded just east of Elby on Half Moon Mountain, a typical rolling Ozark hill. George's dad and stepmother, Susie, added 4 more children to the family: Flora, Martha, Lee, and Earl. The Missouri and North Arkansas Railroad came through Elby in 1906, and the company needed railroad ties for building the railroad to the east. The need for ties provided a rich opportunity for the area's residents to work. The hills had an abundance of native white and red oak trees, which were excellent materials for the ties. George, always looking for a better way to provide for the family, became interested in the making of cross ties, and in the process of time started his own business, hewing ties and selling them to the M&NA. His equipment was a one-man saw, a broad axe, wedges, some made of wood, and a strong determination. As George grew older and wiser, he saved his money. By 1910, he had $500, a mule and a saddle, a cow, a pig, and 40 acres of land, which he had purchased for $200. George's dad also gave him a small house and another 40 acres of land for all the work he had done for the family. George was very thrifty, and he often reminded others, "A penny saved is a penny earned." We come at page 11 with a picture of young George Barnett, about 16 or 17 year old. Turn the page. One sec. Whoops. Let me pause that. Sorry. We come to Ida's childhood days. Ida Jane Lowrance was born December 11, 1895, probably in Lexington, which is down here on the highway 110 here. Old Lexington is called now. Probably in Lexington or Shirley, Arkansas. Her parents were John Bell Lowrance and Nancy Melissa Guffey. She was the second of 7 children, all girls. She was named after her aunt, Ida May Guffey, her mother's younger sister. The name would have been pronounced Idy in an Arkansas draw. Idy. Like Elby is Elba is Elby. So that might give you a little understanding why it's not called, it's called with a Y or an I instead of an A on the end. Ida recalled that in her early childhood days, she went by covered wagon, pulled by oxen from the Arkansas area to the Chickasaw, Oklahoma, where one of her dad's brothers had a ranch. However, they didn't stay long, only a year or two before returning home to Shirley, Arkansas. In about 1902, they moved to Elby, and later her parents took up a homestead on Half Moon Mountain above Elby, and that's where the family of 9 all lived, in a 2-room wooden house on the homestead farm. This is where I'm at right here on Half Moon Mountain, by the way. Idy became the outside farm helper to the delight of her dad, John Lowrance. She matured early in life and became strong. She helped her dad cut wood and haul it to the house. She helped plow, plant, cultivate, and harvest crops. She began building the fire and making breakfast for the family at age 6. She loved life and found time to play with her sisters and with handmade rag dolls. However, there was not much time left for academics. At the most, 3 to 6 months of school a year. There was one pair of shoes between Idie and Mary, her sister. Shoes were required at school, so they took turns wearing the shoes and going to school. Idie completed the third grade, but continued to learn all days of her life, and she loved learning. She often asked questions of her children and grandchildren and listened very carefully to the answers. Idie had a boyfriend at school named Charlie Lassiter. Another family that's been around here, my friend Kenny. A big part of his ancestry. Charlie Lassiter, with whom she occasionally exchanged notes. Since Charlie's brother was a drunk, Idie's father did not allow this relationship to develop. Idie said that she remembered seeing George Barnett when she was young and lived down by the Little Red River. And he came down to work on the railroad section or pick cotton. But George was older, and she never thought of him as a beau until he asked to date her. Idie's father, John Lowrance, could find nothing wrong with George Barnett except for that Idie was quite young. John allowed them to date in the spring of 1909. My grandpa was a year old then, by the way, when Idie was 13, so George came a-courting. She was barefoot, and the first time George came to call on her, and she found this very embarrassing, and they both worked long hours during the week. Sunday was the day that they did most of their dating, going to Sunday school and church together. One time, a carnival came to Elby, and Idie recalls that George offered to buy tickets for both her and her sister, Mary, to go with him. But then Vic, the younger sister, wanted to come too, so he took all three of them to the carnival. They all walked home afterwards up Half Moon Mountain, without any light. I got a story on that, boys, walking with a flick of at least a big lighter. That'll be left for another tale. I got to tell part of it. Down to a wedding off down there at Elby off Half Moon, when the Barnett boys, he come down there with nothing more than the flick of a beak to get him there. He could have done it in the dark, purity, I'm sure. Okay, back in here. Idie had beautiful auburn red hair and a twinkle in her greenish eyes. No wonder she caught the attention of George Barnett. However, this was not all George saw in Idie. It was Idie's energy and her willingness to work that also appealed to George. Idie was a precious child and fully developed physically. It was not hard for Idie's parents to give her away at this tender age, for indeed George was well respected and a man of means. I believe she was 14, 15 year old. I don't remember. I think it may tell again. Here's a picture of George Barnett and Idie Lowrance taken in 1910. Good picture. There's some more falling. Now over to page 14. We come to George and Idie's marriage and first children. So it came to pass that George and Idie met and married in Elby, Arkansas, in Van Buren County. The wedding was July 24th of 1910. Idie was 14 and a half years of age, and George was 24. George gave Idie a small gold wedding band engraved on the inside that says, George and Idie. George had a house and 80 acres when he married Idie, but he had the house rented out to someone. George and Idie had to wait until the family who had rented the place had harvested their crops before they took possession of their home. Pardon. Excuse me. George did not want to wait that long to marry Idie, so after the wedding he took his new bride home to his parents. to their three-room cottage where the two slept in the same bedroom with George's two younger brothers. Idy said they took every opportunity to tease George and her the best they could. So she and George took long walks to enjoy some privacy together. By the end of October, the renters moved out and George and Idy took possession of their home, of their honeymoon cottage. They had to buy furniture, Idy said. That was something, going to Leslie to buy our furniture. They brought a rocking chair, bedsteads, dish pans, and the smallest Buckeye cook stove. But since the rocking chair fell apart and the bedstead kept falling down every time they turned over, Idy decided later in life they didn't know much about how to buy it. However, they mended the chair and the bed, and they kept on using them. A large clock was purchased secondhand about this time, too. They had a feather bed made by George's stepmother. And, of course, homemade quilts to keep them warm. Ida said she didn't know much about cooking on her new cook stove, but when she burned the biscuits, she threw them out and started over again. The recipe was in her head and not something she could repeat, but the ingredients were flour, lard, salt, cow's milk, and baking powder. She said that lard was the only shortening she ever heard of at the time, and cow's milk was the only kind of milk to be had in Elby. There's a, says 10 parentheses there for, I guess, reference would be at the end of there. Not long after they were married, George purchased a log wagon and another mule. With his wagon and team of mules, he hauled ties to the railway yard in Elby. He worked from sunup to sundown and made $2.50 to $3 a day doing this. Then, not long after they were married, George was asked by H.B. McGee to load railroad ties for the National Tie and Timber Company, operated by Mr. McGee. George agreed. He continued to load ties on the Missouri and North Arkansas, that's the M and the NA, working for Blair McGee for many years. George was 5'11" and weighed 165 pounds. He had blue eyes and a fair complexion. George developed strong muscles lifting and loading the heavy railroad ties. Idy stayed home, and at first she was lonely staying alone all day, but it wasn't long before she learned there was a baby on the way. Iva Lee was her first child, and then it wasn't long before Idy was pregnant with the second child. She had heard that if you're pregnant and make a wish, then roll over, then all the wishes will come true. So when she knew that she was pregnant again, she went to the field, wished for a boy, and rolled over, and her wish came true. The next child was Irving, the boy for whom she had wished. Dora was next, followed by Doyle and Ray. We'll come across page 15 to some pictures of the Barnett family at the new home house in Elby about 1924, with the left to right of Irving, Iva, Doyle, George, Ida, Ray, and Dora. And below, we have a picture of Doyle, Ray, and U.S. Sterling. I'm not sure who that boy is. He looks brown. Might be Indian. I'm not sure. Then we have a picture of with Dora and a China doll. Turn the page. Page 16. Birth dates for the children were Iva Lee Barnett, born June 10th of 1911, Irvie Lloyd Barnett, born October 6th of 1912, Dora Jane Barnett, born November 17th of 1914, Doyle Malloy Barnett, born March 18th, 1917, Ray Jackson Barnett, born November the 3rd, 1919. So it was that Ida had five children by the time she was 23 years of age. She was young with them and ran and played with them. She enjoyed her children and showed her love by not only helping provide for their physical needs, but by playing heartily with them. She often said, "I never had dolls with which to play in early childhood, so I played with my children as precious dolls." Ida also known to say, I figured out and what was causing all those babies, so I got myself some silk and Vaseline, and that worked. I'm not sure how that worked. Well, one might guess. George and Ida's first family home was a one-room log cabin with a small side kitchen built on 40 acres of land on Half Moon Mountain above Elby. Iva, Irvy, and Dora were born in this house. In the spring of 1915, when Dora was learning to crawl, the family moved down the hill to an acreage on the other side of the river and called the River Farm. The family had a small rowboat to get across the river to Elby. The property contained about 60 acres of land that stretched in a rectangle along the banks of the Middle Fork of the Little Red River. George was concerned about flooding, so he rented a place in Elby called the House by the Well, so named because it was near one of the town's public wells, and folks went there for water when they did not have a well of their own. Abraham Barnett, as George's brother, was a well digger and had dug the well. George and Ida still did their farming on the river farm. George secured a small parcel on the nearby hill ground at the base of Half Moon Mountain on the other side of the town well, and had built a new home built for his growing family. They moved into their new house in the fall of 1918, just before Ray was born, and lived there for the next 10 years. The first three homes had been built one-room cottages with a kitchen, so the children always slept in the living room with their parents. The new house was much larger, and it had one long bedroom upstairs where the children slept, while George and Ida slept downstairs in the living room by themselves. Ida told Dory this story, which occurred around 1913. When Irvy was a babe in arms and Iva a toddler, Ida went walking down Half Moon Mountain to Elby. She heard a scream like a woman, and it did not take long to figure out that this was the sound of a panther, the mountain lion of the Ozarks. She had heard that these creatures like to snatch babies, so she wasted no time getting to town. The screaming came closer and closer. Sometimes she could see the bushes move. Although she never saw the panther, she avoided getting too close to the side of the road and didn't pause for anything. She went as fast as Ivy's little legs would go. Finally, she arrived safely in town, breathless and afraid. This was much too narrow an escape for her, and she found someone to escort her back home. They walked everywhere. They went around Elby. Of course, they had to take the train when they went to Leslie. They visited Ida's parents often and went out on the mountain to see them, as the saying goes. About once a month, Ida would take her children and walk about 5 or 6 miles to see her sister, Victoria, and Vic's husband, Frank Hobbs, over in Rumley, Arkansas. Now, that's up there, you said, in pretty near close to the head of the Little Red, there, the Middle Fork at Rumley. And you can float from there to Elby, and Elby on down. Well, you can go all the way to now, it's the lake there. It'd take a while to do it, depending on the river flow. All right, so I've interrupted there. All right, back to Rumley. There were swinging footbridges over the Little Red River to get to Aunt Vic's house, and the family had to cross these bridges. There was one at Rumley and one at Allberg, and often they were in disrepair with holes and the decking making them a challenge to navigate across. Now, down at Allberg, there's a low rock water bridge there, and then another low water bridge past it before Shirley is where I camped out. And I got videos up on that out there, a little canoe tripping. Anyways, where'd I go? Challenging to navigate across. Next page. We have on page 17, it's a reproduction here of Missouri and North Arkansas Railroad Company, and stuff much too small for me to attempt to pull out with my eyes here. So anyways, we'll skip that. Well, to page 18, it's the new house at LB, Arkansas. It's a photograph here. There's a hog up there and a garden fenced off. And a house in the background nestled right up against a half moon there at the bottom. So this is the Barnett House at the foot of Half Moon Mountain, where Ray was born. Built in 1918, it was located somewhat behind Johnson's store in Elby. The smokehouse is out of sight in the trees to the left of the house, and the barn is to the right in picture behind the house. And the pond is behind the barn. The family garden is to the right of the house inside the fence. The two gardens in front of the picture belong to neighbors. You can see someone at the town well at the right of the picture. And a spring behind the barn caused the stream. A spring behind the barn caused the stream that ran down the road in the picture. I'm seeing that, sure enough, right there in the picture. Now I've lost my place again. Here we go. And sometime after moving to Gentry in 1928-29, George traded this house and small acreage to John Sterling for 2 miles. So here's the layout showing the house, the new house in Elby. The front porch, and they got a wash bench out front. Inside, you've got the china cabinet in the kitchen cabinet, and the cook stove, and the table, and wood box, and chimney, and a stairway upstairs. Got a laundry bench on the back porch. You got a chest and bed in the next room, a rocking chair, and a sewing machine, and a heating stove, and in the living room there, and a dresser. So this sketch is not in scale, but depicts the household arrangement. There's a big porch across the front of the house, and this is where the kids often played. The girls played dolls, and the boys played marbles. It is where the corn was shucked and the beans were shelled. A bench was beside the kitchen door with a bucket and a wash basin, where the family washed up in summer. The living room doubled as a master bedroom. Ida's sewing machine was there, and a large heating stove with a hearth was in the middle of the room. The kitchen had a cabinet by the door that had a work surface and large tip-out bins for both flour and cornmeal. The china cabinet held the dishes and silverware. A stairway by the back door led up to the children's bedroom upstairs. The five children were divided among three beds. In winter, it got very cold inside in the house at night, and the wind could blow through the cracks. Let's do that again. In winter, it got very cold inside the house at night, and the wind could blow through the cracks. They had wool blankets on the feather beds to help them keep warm, and outside the back door was a bench for the laundry tubs. One tub was brought inside on Saturday and set beside the cook stove in the back door. And everyone had a turn to take a bath in it. The rain barrel outside caught the rain from the roof, and this soft water was used for washing hair. Water was also brought from the nearby town well. That's page 19. Page 20 is photographs. It has Watkins store in Elby is taken in 1909 with Phil Honeycutt and his team of oxen in front of the store. And Idy purchased Ivy Lee's first baby dress in this store. We've got a picture of Dora, Ivy, and Doral. It said the well house is to the left of the tree, and the new house is right of picture. Then there's a Barnett family of Iva, George, and Idy, Doyle, Ray, Dara, and Irvy. Page 21, Beliefs and Experiences. Folks in Elby and the Ozarks believed in ghosts. When Idy's children visited Aunt Vic and Uncle Frank, They would sit around the fireplace after dark, and Uncle Frank would tell ghost stories that would make chills run up their spine. One punishment for children was to put them outside in the dark. So one time when Doyle was a naughty, about 6 or 7 years of age, he was put out of the house in the dark. He just screamed to get back inside, and suddenly his screaming changed, and his mother let him back inside. He sobbed out the story that he had seen an animal of some kind approaching. No wonder with Uncle Perry's preaching about the devil, Uncle Frank's ghost stories, and the wild critters lurking in the dark. The outside was a fearful place, particularly for children. Another time, some of the children wanted to sleep outside. Irvy had built the playhouse, and the children had decided this would be a good place to sleep. Idy said no, but the children persisted. Finally, she gave in, and with glee they went out and settled for the night. It wasn't long until they noticed a ghostly form coming towards them in the night. The noise coming from it was a low, long, ooh. And they ran quickly into the house, just making it in time. I got caught laughing there. a message from Grimner. Redneck ghost stories are kind of scary, he says. Where'd I leave off? Oh, suddenly, let me start back here somewhere. Oh, I've lost my place. Laughing here. No wonder. I'll start right here. No wonder. With Uncle Perry's preaching about the devil, Uncle Frank's ghost stories, and the wild critters lurking in the dark, the outside was a fearful place, particularly for children. Another time, some of the children wanted to sleep outside. Irvy had built the playhouse. I've done read that, and there I am. Later they learned the ghost was their own mother, draped in a sheet. We kind of figured it might have been. That didn't matter. They were sufficiently scared and were cured of sleeping outside. One of the men that worked with George loading ties was quite an ornery man. He stole some goods and was shot, but escaped, leaving a trail of blood. He was tracked to his house and out the back door, and finally was trapped where he was trying to hide in a cave. He was prosecuted and in prison for his thievery. When he got out of jail, he was no better, and he used to curse and say, If there is a God, let him strike me dead with a lightning. It was not really a surprise to any of the local folks when he was out driving his team one day, and he and his team of horses were all struck dead by lightning. A coincidence, some say, but all the family believed it was the hand of God. When Irvy was about 12 years old, he went to visit a neighbor. They had a radio, and having never seen one before, he came back home and reported, "Mama, they have a man in a box. I can hear him talking." Well, we come to Elby in school days. Elby was a thriving little community with a census of approximately 200 people. It was at its height about 1918 during World War I. The town had a Masonic lodge, and it still stands there, one of the few remaining structures down there from the original. And look at I forgot what they call that, the cornerstone, I think. They had some stuff up in there, some old cook stove upstairs in the attic. I don't know. I'm not sure what's all in there. My friend's boy, he was married there. That was a story I was telling a little bit earlier about Daniel Barnett walking off in the pitch dark down off the mountain down there to the wedding. And we kicked it up and did a little dancing, sure enough. But anyways, let's go back here to Elby and school days. Elby was a thriving little community with the 200 people, as I read. And, yes, here it is. The town had a Masonic Hall, schoolhouse, blacksmith shop, grist mill, barber shop, and two stores where you could get soda pop, buy items to make sandwiches, and purchase groceries. It also had a two-story frame country hotel where you could get 3 square meals a day. There were 3 general stores, excuse me, there are three general stores in Elbing, the post office being one of the stores, and the train depot for the Missouri and North Arkansas Railroad. There are two streams in Elbing. I've walked you off down there from up here. Well, let's read about it. There are two streams in Elbing that join together and flow into the Little Red River. The Half Moon Creek flows off the mountain and then into Lynn Creek. Then Lynn Creek flows into the Little Red River. We come to page 22 and we have some photographs. We've got school children in Elbing, about 19 and 25 or 26. Bottom group left to right is Virgil Oaf. Ha! Oh, Dan Oaf. He's a man. His family's still here. Him, his brother Dan. Well, let's go and read these. Virgil Oaf. Amos Passmore. Passmore. That's another folks been around here a long time. His Passmore married a Lucider. Lassiter. I'm just kidding. Lucider. That's how the Yankees say his name. Pronounce Lassiter. Which, by the way, is a cousin to the famous Lassiter that some listening live right now might know about, I'm sure. All right, back into this. So we've got Amos Passmore, Johnny Rowland, R.V. Rowland, Arthur Rowland, Ray Barnett, U.S. Sterling. What a name. We got Gladys Branscombe, Ray Cooley. There's Cooleys right here left on the mountain still today. Gus Cooley, Ruby Passmore, Maudine Sterling, and Essie Oaf. We've got Nell Newport is the teacher. The back group is Oma Isaac, Chester Conant, Vernon Oaf, Blithia Passmore, Ivan Lee Barnett, Ruth Isaac, Irvy Barnett, Dora Barnett, Owen Conant, Doyle Barnett, and Otis Isaac. Here's a picture of the Mason's insignia. Still there. Is that one up there? I'll have to look next time I go. Located high above the front door on the Elbing Schoolhouse, Masons met in the second floor meeting hall once or more times a month. Page 23. How many pages in the first chapter? I'm probably going to have to take a little pause before I'm through, I'm sure. Let's go one more page here and I'll take a little pause. At page 23, we have the schoolhouse in Elbing. The schoolhouse in Elbing still stood at the front of Half Moon Mountain as of 2005, and it is still there today. And this is September the 26th of 2019, almost 1 o'clock in the afternoon on Half Moon Mountain. The schoolhouse in Elbing still stood at the foot of Half Moon Mountain as of 2005. Gone is the pot-bellied stove that was in the middle of the room. The blackboards are gone, and so are the desks. However, memories of school days in Elbing live on. Doyle tells the story of how he was so afraid of the teacher that when he went to school in the morning, he hid in the grass outside until time to go home for lunch. He did this several days before he was discovered and had to return to school. When the school bell rang, everybody had to line up and march inside. Dora Barnett and Lois Branscombe were late one day, so when placed inside a large cardboard box for punishment, they could hear voices outside the box mention that they would be loaded on the train. They could feel that the box was being carried somewhere and then moved about again. Inside, the girls were terribly frightened, and they thought that they had been placed on the train and shipped out of town. Finally, the box was opened, and they found that they had been taken to the upstairs of the school, which was the Masonic Lodge. When the girls were released from the box, they were told not to be late again, and they were not. One day at noon, the students were all lined up to go back inside the classroom, and another boy walked up with a rock beside the door and laid a dynamite cap on the rock and smashed it with another rock. There was a bang, and the boy walked back to the line with a thumb and finger missing. His prank, uh, his practice scare backfired, I reckon. So he was taken about 12 miles to Leslie by a manual-operated railroad handcart to get medical attention. Ray remembers fighting during noon hours and recess. For entertainment, some of the big boys would rub two young boys' noses together until one got hurt and a fight started. Ray's oldest sister, Iva, would stop it when she was around, and the big boys fled away. Betty Jo remembers that her mother... is this Betty Jo? Let's find her last name. Maybe I'll come along. I'm wondering if this is who I'm thinking is. Betty Jo remembers that her mother, Iva, told about the teacher that took Iva and another student by the hair and knocked their heads together. Fightful. All remember that there was no plumbing and only one outhouse. The girls used the outhouse or went up the hill, and the boys found a bush in another direction. In the other direction. There was a well by the side of the door where they drew the water. Recess time at school included games of marbles, blacksmith, and a game called shinny, which was like hockey, but the puck is a tin can, and the hockey stick was a plain stick with a knot in the end. Softball was another of their favorite games. The ball was made out of old socks tied together and string wrapped around and around the socks. For a bat, the boys went into the woods and got a stick and cut it to the right length. They made a pretty good bat from this. Nadora recalls being chosen to recite poetry, and Doyle remembers being able to beat the teacher at a math problem. And, of course, there were spelling bees. They had only one teacher at first, but as the school grew and a second teacher was hired, and the upstairs became the second classroom. When the family lived across the river, the children had to carry their lunch to school. The lunch pail was a bucket, which was covered with a clean cloth. Iva, the oldest, was put in charge of. Handing out the lunch. The family never had light bread in Elby, but they had biscuits, molasses, and butter mixed together with the toppings. Sometimes there was a pint jar of beans. Always some meat like ham or bacon or a boiled egg. Sometimes there was an apple eat. Later, when they lived near the school, they went home for lunch. So that's. Let me back up here, and we're going to go back here to page 24. And we've got pictures at the top of 24. We've got Elvis school children and teacher in 1927 and 8. The back row is Oma Isaacs, Mary Henley, Virgil Loaf, Ruth Isaac, Bertha Passmore, Bids Hobbs, Dora Barnett, Iva Barnett, Myrtle Sterling, Sherman Bobbs, Harrison Allred, this is a teacher, Adol Barnett, Ola Passmore, Vernon Oaf, Irvy Barnett, Adam Bates. The second row is Violet Passmore, Ruby is S.E. Oaf, come back here, Ruby, Ruby Sterling, Gladys Brascom, Alfie Branscom, Ruby Hobbs. In the front row, we've got, first name is not known, Sterling, Johnny Rowland, Arthur Rowland, U.S. Sterling, Ray Barnett, and Mildred Hobbs. Below that, we have the Elby Schoolhouse with Flurry Barnett in the foreground. The school bell and the tower rang when it was time for school to start. Flurry, pictured here, was George's half-sister. Page 25. We've got family gathering in Elby, Arkansas, taken about 1913. The back left, back row, left to right, we've got Monroe Barnett, Flurry Barnett. We got Preacher Nick, George Barnett, Harv Moody, Robert Martin Barnett, and Abraham Barnett. The front row, left to right, is Martha Barnett, Idy Barnett, Irvy Barnett on Idy's lap, Iva Barnett, Bertha Moody. We got a Moody child, Susie Barnett, wife of Robert and Lee Barnett. Below, we've got the picture of Idy, Doyle, Dora, and Ivy Lee, taken in 19 and 18. And there we've got a picture of the Little Red River as it flows by in Elby, Arkansas. Now we'll come back to page 26. We've come to Medicine and Cures. And let's see where we're at in the index. Backing up a little bit. Turning pages. And here we go. Alright, so 26. We're going to come to a pause here. There's 59 total pages here in this first chapter. I like to put all this together in a one setting, but I think I'll take a pause here. Hey, thank you, Grimner. Well, we're posting here at reallibertymedia.com where I'm broadcasting. We have medicine and cures. The girls always wore dresses except for when they went into the woods. Since they had no overalls, they wore the brothers' clothes into the woods. First aid. Idy always took a bottle of turpentine or kerosene and cloth for a bandage. She used this as an antiseptic and also to remove ticks and jiggers. That's a good trick, I'm telling you. Put it dabbing on you. My grandpa used to do that, dab his breeches legs to keep him from getting on there. With kerosene. So kerosene was purchased at Johnson's store in Elby. And sometimes when Dora was sent to the store to get the kerosene in the pail with a spout on it, the store would be closed. However, Mr. Johnson always opened the store for her and gave her candy when she left. Turpentine was purchased in Elby and also in Leslie when they went there by train about 13 miles away. Turpentine was used for sores, boils, gashes, and sometimes taken internally by placing a few drops in a teaspoon of sugar. Emergencies were not foreign to the family, and neither were the remedies. One day, George stuck a pitchfork in his leg. Turpentine or kerosene helped it heal. When Ray was about six, he was climbing in the mulberry tree and fell out. He fell feet first, but his head hit a rock, leaving a gash in his forehead and a spurt of blood running down his face. He got up and ran rapidly to the house, crawled over the two fences, and arrived at the house with the question, "Mama, am I going to die?" Blood was gushing from his head, and cool spring water and turpentine were probably the remedies. The next day, Mama took him by train to the doctor in Leslie, where the wound was stitched. The doctor gave him a quarter for being a good boy. When Ray was about 3 years old, he took a hammer and hit Dora in the head, causing her to go unconscious. The cure for that? George walked Ray about 10 feet across the room. Yes, that cured Ray, at least. Excuse me. Sure cure. Pardon. The children had a toy they called the Flying Jenny. It was a board and spike in it that was stuck in a stump. It had come off the stump, and Dora stepped on it. The spike went almost through her foot until the foot was bulging out the top. Ray recalls that she was running so swiftly when she stepped on the spike, her speed enabled her to pull the spike out of her foot. The remedy for that was to soak her foot in kerosene all night, then take the train to Leslie the next day to see the doctor. They got on the 10 a.m. train and back on the 3 p.m. train. The doctor gave her a tetanus shot, but had to send a marshal for this. The tetanus shot came just in time for Dora to get it and then get back on the train and go home. Evie chopped his toe off with an axe. The toe almost fell off. The cure? You guessed it. Soak it in kerosene. And Idy carefully put it back in place with a bandage. Yeah, she saved his toe and with her home remedies. Irby, he swallowed a safety pin when he was about 5 years old. Someone turned him upside down until the pin came out. Well, here's some pictures here on page 27. Swimming in the Little Red River. Boy, I've been swimming there many, many times. Sometimes when you hear me say I'm going to the river, that might be the spot I've gone. On the left to right, we've got Irby Barnett, Uncle Monroe Barnett, and Uncle Abraham Barnett. down below is a picture of George and Ida Barnett chopping and gathering firewood in Elby about 1920. Well, let's see here. Page 28. I'll read down to the next takeoff, which will be a stopping point here for me. I'm going to take a little break here. Pause the recording. Top of page 28. Ida had a toothache when she was still a teenager. And there was a man named Mr. Woodall. This comes being. There's a trail off the mountain here called Woodall Trail. That be more history to come around about Mr. Woodall, I imagine, in this book. So, anyways, the man was named Mr. Woodall, who lived on Half Moon and was known for his ability to assist with dental needs. He cut around her tooth with a knife sterilized by fire, and with some sort of pliers, he yanked it out. She recalled this as being very painful and said, you have to set your mind to bearing the pain. This is sort of dentistry. She needed dentures at a fairly young age. Once while Dora was swimming in the Little Red River on her dad's back, she felt pain in her toes and looked. Let me see. She felt pain in her toes. They looked, and a leech had attached itself between her two smallest toes. Excuse me. George, he got out his knife and cut it right there. Painful? Yeah, she said that it was. Crushed mullein leaves was a cure for boils and sores. They were held to the sore with a cloth bandage. Sassafras tea was used as an internal cleansing, and George dug the sassafras roots, washed them, and Ida boiled them. Everyone had to drink the tea, but a little bit of honey was added to help the flavor. I like sassafras. I'll chew shoots all the time. Yeah, they're good. And definitely a good cleanse of the blood. Spring tonic, they called it when I was a kid. My grandma would make it. For burns, the area was held over heat, and this would draw the fire out. Wow. Let me read that again, because I don't think I've heard this. For burns, the area was held. Grimner says he has a sister with the last name of Woodall. It's a half-sister. Interesting. Yeah, it's not a name that I've heard often, Woodall. Okay. Where was I? Lysol, sassafras. Everyone had to, with a little bit of honey. For burns, the area, here we go. For burns, the area was held over heat, and this would draw the fire out. I'm going to try this next time I burn myself. And to draw the fire out of the burn. Charcoal was used on sores. Yeah, charcoal is a very good agent, sure enough. Okay, Lysol was a later remedy, and diluted with water used for cleaning sores. Salt water was also used for sores, or straight salt into a wound, even thought though it would burn. Soda was used on bites and bee stings. Chewing tobacco also was used. That's what my grandpa used to use. Get stung by a wasp. And used as a poultice on bee stings. A box of sulfur powder was a remedy for sores and cuts. None of the family got a snake bite in Elby, although poisonous snakes were plentiful. Sometime in 1917 or 1918, George took the train to Little Rock by himself, probably at the recommendation of Dr. Dickens in Leslie. And he had surgery there with left an abdominal scar on his left side up to his navel. The surgery was for some sort of constriction of the bowels. Undoubtedly, the Lord preserved his life. The children often wondered what would have happened to the family if he had not lived. I'm going to pause here and come back to of eating and surviving off the land on page 28. And I'm back. I had a little break there. And coming back in at page 28. And we're starting out here in the middle of the page of eating and surviving off the land. The family ate a big breakfast and a big noon meal. There were homemade biscuits every morning. Oatmeal, eggs, bacon or ham was also on the breakfast menu. Here's my favorite, gravy. Oh, I think I got gravy in my blood. Gravy over biscuits was good too. They ate okra, fried in cornmeal, so the okra wasn't so slimy. Supper consisted of cornbread and fruit or vegetables and whole milk. I decanned the fruit in half-gallon jars so that there'd be enough. She canned peaches from her father's peach tree. They also took the wagon and team to the woods to pick huckleberries and blackberries. They could pick a bucket full from one bush, and soon a wash tub would be filled. Though it seemed like a long time to the children, these were canned. Apples were dried. There was a wild muscadine grape that was made into jelly. In the fall, they gathered nuts, hickory, chinkapins. There ain't hardly any chinkapins around here anymore. And black walnuts. I'd say it's them. The black walnuts were hard to crack and get the meat out of, but once a year they would get a bandana. I'm sorry, get a banana. One Christmas they got oranges, the first that some in the family had ever seen. Sometimes at Christmas they'd get taffy made from molasses. Ola also remembers that Idy made wonderful donuts, which were a special treat to everyone. Dora remembers that occasionally George would cut down a bee tree and collect the honey in the comb. The comb was chewed like gum. They raised chickens, mules, cows, geese, and hogs on the family farm. They had Rhode Island Reds and Wyandotte chickens. Most of the roosters were killed for meat, and the traditional Sunday morning breakfast was fried chicken. The children often fussed over who would get the pulley bone. Horses provided the power to pull the wagon. Cows provided the milk, cream, and butter for the family. And Ida raised geese, which she also used for plucking down. The down made the softest pillows and beds. Oh, if you ain't never slept on a feather bed. Floating in a cloud. Until they get mashed down. Well, then you got to fluff them. Anyways, let's go back here. When the hogs were butchered in the fall, the shoulder, bacon, and hams would be cut up and placed in a pork barrel with layers of salt to preserve it. The hams were cured in the smokehouse. In the winter, it kept pretty well this way. George and the boys would go fishing and catch perch and catfish in the Little Red River for the family to eat. They also had frog legs and eel. One time, George saved the eel skin and stuffed it with sawdust or some filler when Idy's sister came to visit. He threw it towards them. Oh, how they squealed. Well, they raised corn and had their own corn sheller, but took the corn to Elby to be milled. When the corn had grown about 2 feet high, beans were planted to grow up the corn stalks, eliminating staking. Irish potatoes, sweet potatoes, cabbage, turnips, onions, and rutabakers were part of their garden. The whole family would go out to weed the rows, each person taking a row of their own. There was a rule about playing, none of it until the row was done. Sometimes, after weeding, they would go for a swim in the Little Red River. George would take the smaller children on his pack until they learned to swim. As the children grew older and they were varied, work opportunities for them, Dora recalls when, as she was about 10 years old, a wagon, a load of them went down over to Lexington to help Uncle Ed pick cotton. As they drove along one ridge, they saw the next ridge was ablaze with a forest fire. They feared that the fire might catch up with them, but they made it safely out. They made it safely on to pick the cotton and return home. While they were there, they slept under a quilt, and Dora recalls being squished in the middle. Ola recalls a trip to Aunt Rosie Williams' house and Ivan and Dora to pick cotton, but that time it rained, and then they never got to pick the cotton. In the fall, they would dig large holes in the ground and line them with straw and put the food in the ground to store for winter. Potatoes and squash. Potatoes and squash were stored this way. They grew lots of beans and would let them shrivel on the vines and pick and shell them. After boiling them a couple of minutes to kill all the bugs, They would dry them in the sun before storing them for winter. Idy used a ladder to climb up on the roof and put her apples out to dry. The family had a dog named Ring that was best described as a cross between a bull terrier and a collie. He was trained to go after the cattle. When the family took the little paddle boat across the Little Red River, Ring would swim beside the boat. One time, the rats built a nest just above the corn crib and were eating away at a rapid rate. Ring helped dig the rats out and got rid of them. Ring lived for 11 years, and the children were very sad when he died. They provided a full funeral for the beloved pet, including a casket and a service before the burial. Monday or Tuesday was a wash day, and Idy would take all day to do wash. She began by carrying the water and heating it. A wash tub and a rub board were her utensils, and she scrubbed and scrubbed with homemade lye soap until the laundry was very clean. White clothes were boiled on the stove. Spots were treated with ashes if they wouldn't come out with normal scrubbing. Then she starched and hung up the clothes to dry. Her starch recipe was add flour to water and stir until not lumpy. Add this to boiling water while stirring, then. Cool it, then thin with some more water and dip the clothes in them, then dry. Let's turn the page. Page 30. When she was finished and washing the clothes, she took the soapy water and put it on the floor and swept and swept until there's no dirt left anywhere. She'd even turn the chairs upside down and wash the legs of the chair every week. No one was allowed to walk on the floor until it was dry. She would beat the homemade braided rugs with a stick or broom handle until clean and put them back on the floor. The day following wash day was the day Idy ironed. That took another whole day. She ironed with old sad irons, which she heated on the wood stove. Pillowcases and bed sheets and the like were all starched and ironed. Saturday was bath day, and everyone had his or her turn to bathe. Sunday they went to the Baptist church up on Half Moon Mountain, still here today. Idy was always busy. She usually had a quilt she was working on. She also cut hair. She gardened. Idy was highly skilled at making clothing. She could look at a dress and go home and make it without a pattern. She'd go to Leslie on the train and buy the thread, needles, and cloth, look at the new styles, and then go home and cut out the pieces and sew them into fine-looking clothing. She was actually a tailor because she had such excellent sewing skills. Occasionally, she would buy a ready-made dress. Dora remembers one dress made of silk pongee, P-O-N-G-E-E, that her mother bought through the Montgomery Ward catalog. What a surprise to her when a neighbor girl appeared with the same dress purchased from the same catalog. The boys and men's suits were purchased in Leslie. But other than those occasional events, Idy made everything from underwear to coats. They were among the best dressed family in town. Idy had a poem that she loved to recite to her children. She also lived it. The poem goes like this. One thing at a time is the name. Work while you work, play while you play. This is the way to be cheerful and gay. All that you do, do with your might. Things done by halves are never done right. One thing each time, and that done well, is a very good rule, as many can tell. Moments are useless, trifled away, so you work while you work and play while you play. From M.A. Stoddart. I wrote that poem. We go to page 31 in pictures of Jake Johnson and his wife Laura, who owned the Johnson store. And there would be the picture of Johnson's store in Elby. This is a store where the family bought lamp oil. Notice the railroad ties that are split and stacked. The loading by the tracks of the M and N.A. Railroad run through Elby. The river is just beyond the stack of ties, and the light spot at the bottom of the picture is a reflection from a mud puddle. Sure enough. We go to page 32. This tells us of the flood. In the spring of 1927, a flood came through Elby. The Little Red River flooded more than anyone could remember. It flooded the bottom lands and washed away George's entire cornfield, including the topsoil, turning his farmland into a rock bed. The floodwaters did not go into the town of Elby itself. One reason for this was that the railroad bed acted like a dike to keep the floods out. Although the farmland now was unfarmable, George was able later to sell his 60-acre river farm to the Ormond family. Authorities recorded that this flood lasted April the 16th to the 24th of 1927 and was more than a local event in what President Herbert Hoover called the greatest peacetime disaster in U.S. history. Heavy rains caused the Mississippi River to flood much of its lower valleys, backing up the Arkansas River along its entire length. Over one-fifth of the state's total area was inundated. About 25 million acres in 56 counties, most transportation structures and communication facilities were unusable. This event ultimately led to a federal flood control legislation. Prosperity and the M and the NA. The town of Elby was a railroad town, and its growth and demise was directly related to the M and NA Railroad. The railroad was started in 1883 a short line into the healing waters of Eureka Springs. Then it was expanded, and under the name of the St. Louis and North Arkansas Railway, it reached Harrison by 1901. Financial trouble plagued the line from the beginning, and by 1906, the line was reorganized and called the Missouri and North Arkansas. Although the initials M and NA stand for the Missouri and North Arkansas, it was affectionately called the May Never Arrive because of its many troubles. However, top speed of this top speeds of this new railway was 25 miles an hour, which was pretty good for a narrow gauge mountain railroad. The line through Elby was constructed in 1906. In fact, all the line between Leslie and Searcy was constructed in 1 year. Leslie is mile board 182 on the M&NA, and Searcy is mile board 274, which means they actually constructed 92 miles in 1 year. This work was done by common labor and mules. Blasting was done with black powder. The holes for the black powder were dug by hand. One man turned the drill bit, and two men struck the drill bit with hammers. The little mountain village near Leslie became the headquarters for extending the rails on the southeast towards Helena. The H.D. Williams Cooperage Company, which furnished employment for almost everyone in Leslie, was reported to be the largest barrel factory of its kind in the world. When running at full capacity, they could produce 5,000 barrels a day. There were several portable mills that moved about the area. Barrels manufactured in Leslie, as well as cross ties, were the two main exports of the area and one of the money-making cargoes for the M and NA. These exports also gradually depleted the forests of available virgin red and white oak. You can still find them again today, though, but not... Herbie Prouton passed away some years ago, but he knew some history about around here. See pictures, wondered how they'd ever get around way back when they come here in the earlier 1800s. But the canopy of trees were so huge and expansive, and You don't have the undergrowth that you see today, and then you get clear cuts, and it all grows back up. And anyway, some 50 years later, you get back to where you got a tree, giving you some enjoyment and or reharvest. Well, where am I? Back here, a train wreck in 1914 on the MNNA killed about 35 passengers and almost completely gutted the treasury of the MNNA by payments to families of victims. In January 1918, well, we got to skip a page here, and I'll come back to it for the pictures. In 1918, when World War I was going in full swing, Uncle Sam assumed control of all railroads. They standardized the rail system, and the employees of the MNNA saw that their paychecks about double in size. Then in June of 1918, control was given back to the MNNA owners. They were not able to maintain the wages to which the employees had grown accustomed. The government stepped in and helped for 18 months. Then control was returned to the owners on March 1st, 1920. The employees along the railroad line would not accept the cut in pay that was being dished out to them, since they had unanswered questions like why the owner of the company was able to sell his private rail card and credit this to his own personal account. Thus, a strike was called by the workers on the MNNA and it began in February 1921. They had no inkling of what was to come. Strike-breaking strangers came to most of the towns along the line, although no one in the immediate family directly recalls any strike-breakers in Elby. Many of the new employees carried weapons. People began to take sides as the supplies of staple goods was either exhausted or were dwindling, and prices were soaring. In March, two of the trestles on the line were torched, and for a while all traffic halted completely. Private citizens tried to patrol the railroad, but still the vandalism continued. Blue vitriol, copper sulfate, was poured into the water tanks, and the resulting acid attacked locomotive boilers and cylinders, severely damaging them. Machine bearings were given application of emery dust to make them useless. The strikers tampered with track switches, air brake hoses. air brake hoses were cut and more trestles were burned. Other rail lines would not sell tickets for the MNNA. Spikes were pulled, permitting the rails to turn over when trains rolled across, and employees were intimidated or beaten. It became unsafe to operate the MNNA, and the lines were closed down again. In June 1921, the U.S. District Court tries to step in. By this time, many businesses were bankrupt, and people were moving to an area where employment might be secured. The line was never a money-making business, so the owners proposed closing the line. The new owner was found, but by this time the shopmen had been on strike 15 months and the road had been shut down 9 months. The roadbed was in horrible condition and the locomotives, left setting with blue vitriol in their boilers and cylinders, were acid corroded hulks. In summary, the Missouri and North Arkansas was in pitiful shape. Under new ownership, fresh acts of vandalism began with renewed vigor. More bridges were burned. Both the strikers and the new employees began to openly carry guns. On January 15th, 1923, someone put out the word that the people of the Hill Country began to pour into the towns of Harrison. A vigilante group known as the Committee of 12 was formed, and with the help of the citizens, and not the law, they began to round up persons responsible for the vandalism during the strike. A man named Ed Greger, who had been living out of town to find work during the strike, resisted the vigilante interrogations, and gunfire broke out. his wife persuaded him to go with the gang. However, they didn't like his answers, and next morning, his body was found hanging from a railroad bridge. He was hanged to death. The vigilante group continued to hold court for 1 week. During this time, the mayor, the city of Marshall, and members of the Harrison City Council were forced to resign and leave town. On January 19th of 1923, the reign of the Committee of Twelve came to an end. Men had been beaten, flogged, intimidated, run out of town, and one had been murdered, but the strike was broken. However, business did not revive as the years passed. Let's back up to what I skipped over. And this is a picture. Above is a picture of Monroe Barnett in the doorway of the boxcar loading Ties and Leslie. Oh boy, them some big ones. To the left is a copy of his logbook. He kept track of George's ties on this day as well as others. We've got tie stacking for H.B. McGee, G.J. Barnett, $10.38, the same to L.G. Branscombe. We've got $8.88 to J.M. Barnett and Clyde Kula, $3.67. Lunch wreck with a question mark. Bill, I don't know what that means, so lunch wreck. Bill is 3,325 ties. We got pushes of 34.35. So did we get a total pools of 6,760 ties. And I don't understand those wordings of what those mean. That'd be something to look up. All right, where'd I leave off? I ran through here and over here. So we go to page 35 with some more pictures. We've got the loaders at Shirley, Arkansas. We've got George Barnett is the third man down from the top, man down the ramp from the boxcar. Blair McGee, the supervisor, is at the bottom of the ramp wearing a tie. Then we have 1926, getting ties of the stack. And, excuse me, two men lifted a tie and helped center it. Pardon. And helped center it on the tie loader's shoulder. Phew. Man. George on the far right, McGee and Sue on the left. Then we have a loading tie into a gondola car by hand. It's a picture. George is on the far right again. McGee standing on the tie. Wearing a suit and tie. McGee. On the tie, in a tie. All right. Where was I? I left there. Okay. Coming on over. Page 36. The top. In 1927, the line was in receivership again, and in 1935 it went into foreclosure, and the name was changed to Missouri and Arkansas. The organization floundered also, and the name was changed to the Helena and Northwestern. Then it became the cotton plant, Fargo, then the Arkansas and Ozarks. Eventually the train service to Elby died and the tracks were taken up. Come to the move. Thus it was that the devastation left by the floodwaters of the Little Red River and the effects of the financial problems on the M&NA, the sagging economy of Elby and the dwindling oak trees from which to make the railroad ties, the uncertain job market and even more uncertain transportation took its toll on the local families. These things helped George United to decide it was time to move. George left first, taking a job with Mr. Blair McGee, who had already moved to Benton County. That's where my family come to in 1854. It was in Arkansas from Tennessee. Benton County, Arkansas. Yes, just so that's where Gentry's at. Cousins from around there. Where would I leave off at? Here's CC. Yesterday and George left, taking first the job there, and moved to Benton County from Elby. Then on December 31st, 1928, the rest of the Barnett family left Elby for Benton County and Siloam Springs and Gentry area. Everyone was crying. Doris said that she was not crying until her grandfather, John Bell Laurent, said, "Your time is coming." And she started crying too. The family went by train from Elby to Leslie, about 13 miles. And George had hired a man from the Siloam Springs area with a Chevrolet 3/4 ton truck who met them in Leslie. The family loaded all their belongings on the truck and headed west. It was winter, and there's no heat in the truck. They stopped along the way to build a bonfire and heated stones to keep them warm. Dora recalls that she thought she'd freeze to death. She also recalls that they crossed the Buffalo River at Grinders Ferry. They arrived in Benton County on January 1st, 1929. There were only wagon roads out of Elby, and none of the roads were paved. There were dirt highways from Leslie to Siloam Springs. State highways were graveled. Highway 110 up here wasn't paved, I think, until the 70s. Maybe it was sometime. The other story goes, you'd know who was coming by the sound of the vehicle on the road. Maybe the ones I've heard. I can tell out here going by my place. Let me get back to where it was at. The family first lived near Gentry on a 3-mile lane in a 4-room house with a porch. The house was rented from Blair McGee. The first winter was an exceptionally hard winter with about 20 inches of snow on the ground. The rabbits were in abundance, but they couldn't run fast because the snow was so deep. The boys used the newspapers and feed sacks to wrap their shoes and legs when went hunting. They killed over 100 rabbits. Some of the rabbits were sold for 5 cents each. The rabbits not sold were gutted and hung on the back porch, furnishing meat for the household. For 3 weeks, the temperature stayed below freezing, and many of the rabbits were eaten. In Gentry, George was again employed by Mr. McGee for Coopers Incorporated, which was on the Kansas City Southern line. George oft times walked to work approximately 4 to 5 miles. On longer trips, he traveled by car with Mr. McGee. Sometimes he was gone for a week or more at a time. In October of 1929, George purchased a 139-acre farm on Little Flint Creek for $4,700 without consulting Ida. He withdrew all the savings from the Bank of Leslie, $2,500, as a down payment. Ida was upset about this, but explained that he was afraid that the property would be sold before she could be consulted. She understood. The family move was a good choice because during the Great Depression, which came within the stock market crash of October 24, 1929, the paychecks on the railroad in Elby got 5 months. Got 5 months behind. The railroad simply could not pay its operating expenses because of the terrible depression. This was part of the decline of Elby that eventually caused the post office to be dissolved. And in the 1980s, Elby was removed from the map. The family believed that it was God's hand that led them to move to Benton County, and it was God's spirit that impressed George to withdraw the entire family savings from the bank just 1 week before the stock market crash and the collapse of the banks, including the Bank of Leslie, where they had kept their money. Chartel Mortgage Company in Missouri had repossessed the farm on Little Flint Creek that George purchased. The farm had belonged to a widow who lived there with several grown children. They had difficulty in moving away. The Barnett family had to wait for the widow lady and family to move out, and when she finally did, she left it very dirty. Dora recalls that the widow lady was angry to have lost her house and tried to come at night and dig up the strawberries and to take the windows. She was successful at some of her attempts. Irvy and Ray They don't remember about the strawberries and winters, but they remember that the departing widow's family did cut and sell some virgin timber after the property sale. The Barnett family moved into the home about December of 1929. The interest on the property during the Depression was about 10%. Sometimes all that could be paid was the interest. Some in the community lost everything they had. Work paid 7.5 cents to 10 cents per hour, if it could be found. However, Ida said later in life, "I've heard people talk about a depression. I never noticed it. I've been in a depression all my life." The family farmhouse was much larger than any home the family had lived in previously. There was a big living room, a dining room, and a kitchen, one bedroom downstairs, and three bedrooms upstairs, and a porch outside. The farm had several springs on it and plenty of water. The main spring was south of the house at the edge of the yard, which was really two springs. They provided excellent drinking water and also served as the cooler or refrigerator. Yeah, I remember the spring house. The kid not far from up there where this story is. Then there was a bluff north of the barn which had a small spring, and also there was a bluff downstream south which had a spring. Then, of course, Little Flint Creek ran through the property. The outhouse was downstream from the main springs where the produce was kept. Oh, yes. There was a small spring there, too, that continually flowed to keep it clear. George blasted the cave in the side of a hill, and the boys helped dig and square out a room. Stones were laid, and a wooden door was hung to make a cellar. It was always cool. Potatoes, apples, sweet potatoes, onions, and other items were stored there to preserve them, not only from heat, but from freezing. This was also the place the family took cover if there's a tornado watch. Ida continued to raise ducks and geese, and she used for making pillows and beds. Ida used the pillows for gifts to many lucky grandchildren. Several pillows are still in use. Guinea hens were purchased. They weren't for meat or eggs, but they made a terrible racket if somebody come or something would come around. An automatic alarm system. It's also said that the guinea hens kept snakes away on the farm. George expanded his farming: corn, oats, wheat, sugar cane for sorghum, Irish potatoes, sweet potatoes, strawberries, tomatoes, carrots, peanuts, and alfalfa. Now I'm going to back up here to this pictures I passed. Back to page 37. We got Elby train station and the MNNA waiting for the train on moving day, December the 31st, 1928. That's a fine looking family dressed well. The Barnetts are. George and his family. Below we've got a picture. One of the steam engines used on the MNNA from the Short Line Railroad of Arkansas by Hull. Okay. Now here we are. Back to page 39. How much time have I been running here? Hour and 43 minutes. Well, I think I'm coming close to the end of the chapter, Anna. No, there was 60-something pages, weren't there? Let me look. I'm going to take a... Oh, somebody got that dog-eared. I don't know. I have to go back to... It's quite a bit. I don't think I'll do all of chapter one in one sitting here. Where was I at? All right. What's up, buddy?
I've been sitting here listening to you for a minute, man.
Yeah?
Yeah, I've heard you go through everything, even the pictures and everything else.
Yeah? How you doing? We're live on the radio. I'm recording it. You know, this is Kevin's family. I was showing you there earlier. Yep. I'm going to read here just a little bit more, and I'm going to come to a stopping point. I'm going to pause just a moment right now. Hold on. I'll put something on the plate. Okay, that was Grand Daniel here on the mountain. Come down. We're coming back in at page 39 and top of the page just below beyond the peanuts and alfalfa. We've got where George still owned the property in Elby. So sometime around 1930, he went back to see what he could do to sell it. George was able to barter with John Sterling, who purchased the property for two good mules, an estimated price of $500. George came back in a few weeks. His brother Abraham walked the horses to Berryville, Arkansas. George met him in Berryville and walked him to his place southwest of Gentry, located on Little Flint Creek. The weather was cold, and Ide was deeply concerned for George's safety. He made it home, and his ears had frostbite on them. The total distance traveled was about 170 miles, which took about 6 days. Abram went almost 90 miles, and George about 80 miles. George was dressed in layers of wool, which saved his life. Later, the mares, which were named Frank and Coley, proved their worth, and both produced several colts. Unfortunately, later, one mare was kicked by the other while licking salt, which broke the back leg, leaving the leg hanging by the skin only. A veterinarian was called and could not repair the leg, so the pregnant mare was put down. It was a tremendous loss for a poor and struggling family. Ide was a teenager and quickly noticed that the ways of Siloam Springs and Gentry were much different than the remote, isolated Elby. George had always been called Papa, and Ide had always been called Mama. Now, with the help of Ida, George was called Daddy, and sometimes Mama was called Mother. We come to the birth of the twins and other changes. The family farm near Gentry was the birthplace of the twins, Geneva and Jeanette, on October the 6th of 1933. This was Ide's only birth attended by a doctor. In fact, Dr. Wilson asked for one of the twins instead of the fee of $25. Of course, he was declined. Neither Ide nor the doctor was aware that the twins were on the way. It wasn't until after Geneva was delivered that the doctor became aware that yet another babe, the caboose of the family, was on the way. Irby tells this story that there were even more birds on the farm that day because the sow had 12 piglets and the cat had 6 kittens. It was also Irby's 21st birthday. Quiet and exciting and memorial day with all those births. Twin baby girls and all the animals too. The twins were a highlight in the family, and they made life in the Barnett family even more lively. Dora married Newton McKinney in 1933. She and Newton had a baby daughter, Doris Jean McKinney, born about 2 months after the twins were born. About 18 months later, Newton died. and Doris Jean come to live with Ide and George. Now, there were three girls almost the same age, so Ide often dressed them as triplets. George used to say, "One girl is a girl, two girls are half a girl, and three girls are no girl at all." Or he says, "No girl." I've heard it said about boys the same way when you go to work in them. Well, he was acknowledging how much work he could get out of them. That's exactly right. That's how that goes. Jeanette and Geneva tell the story that the three little girls liked to look in the mirror on top of the bureau in the bedroom. They pulled out the bottom drawer and stood on it so they could see themselves. One day, while all three were standing in the bottom drawer looking in the mirror, the chest of drawers flipped over. Geneva was trapped underneath, but the other two went. Uh-oh, we're going to flip and come back here. Okay, here we go. From 39 over to 43. I'm going to skip over the pictures there. This all needs to be brought about put on a thumbnail where it can be uploaded to the internet. But let me go on. Just let me read this out, because time factor, I'd like to keep us close to 2 hours, but it won't be 2 hours, I'm afraid. All right, so they went to hide. Jeanette found the dirty clothes basket and covered herself with dirty clothes to conceal her place. Mother Ida heard the crash and was there right away. After helping Geneva out from under the dresser, she sent her off to get a switch from the lilac bush for the naughty girls who ran away. But when Jeanette jumped out, of the dirty clothes basket, Ida laughed so hard she never got around to delivering the punishment with the lilac switches. There was probably not one square foot of the 130-acre farm which was not examined and walked over thoroughly. RV and Eva used to take the family group snipe hunting in the fall and winter. Geneva and Jeanette always... I'm laughing because I can imagine where the stories are going. Geneva and Jeanette always took the sacks to put the snipes in. Then there was always the old swimming hole where the kids would go swimming daily in the good old summertime. There were tame white ducks. However, the snapping turtles would pull them under underwater and drown them for a meal. The ducks would lay eggs and nests near the water, so the girls would go wading down the creek and hunting for duck eggs, which were good. Of course, there was always a few hens in the small chicken house. Idy and George also raised broilers as chickens. Then they were sold. Some would always escape and add to the population of the small number of hens on the farm. Naturally, life was extremely busy on the farm with 10 to 12 cows to milk by hand before 7 a.m. and again in the evening. The farm always had horses, which George used to plow the fields and pull trees into the wood yard for wood, the sole source of heat. He used the horses to pull wagons full of freshly picked corn, hay, and even to get rocks out of the field. In order to cultivate the land, the rocks had to be removed by hand. There were many small wild animals on the farm, such as red fox, wolf, coyote, raccoon, opossums, skunks, and of course rodents and snakes. One time when Jeanette was a toddler and couldn't speak plainly yet, she came in holding the baby snake by the tail. And it went up. She went up to her mother and said, "Pretty one, Mommy. Pretty one, Mama," she said. She was holding a copperhead by the tail, and it was capable of killing her with one small bite. Ida instantly recognized the danger and carefully took the snake out and killed it. Jeanette tells the story that one time, while out in the woods, she used some leaves for toilet paper. Those nice leaves turned out to be poison ivy. Her little body was covered with a weeping rash from the leaves, and she missed 3 weeks of school. But she says she never had a rash from poison ivy since. Well, I grew up with poison ivy myself, and some years ago, after moving out here to the mountain, and that made sense to me when it was told, said somebody said, Roscoe French told me, he says, if I was to eat some poison ivy, just a little bit, and, not only would I not get it, but if I had it and ate it, I'd get rid of it. And I've proved this out for, I guess, about the last 15 years. Don't get poison ivy anymore. And there's been the occasion I got a little bump and I ate a piece right away and fixed you right up. Where'd I leave off at? About the poison ivy free ever since. Yep, there was a couple of small caves or indents in the cliff along the stream bed of the property. Water would freeze there in sheets in the winter, and the family would gather the ice from the rocks and use this to make homemade ice cream. The family often went to Gentry on Saturday nights after they purchased a car. Idy was not usually allowed to handle the money, but she selected her groceries and supplies, and George would come in and pay for them afterwards. He generally would be visiting with a farmer friend in Gentry while Idy was selecting groceries. Geneva and Jeanette sometimes went to the steel drugstore for a soda at the old-fashioned soda fountain. Ida usually kept the checking account in order, and later she did write the checks. George would sign his name to the checks, but usually Ida had to explain what he was signing. However, George was an extremely sharp business person, and he could figure amounts more quickly in his head than most people could with pencil and paper. George liked to carry large amounts of money. One time when Dora ironed his suit, she found 5 $100 bills in the pocket. Just think what that would be worth today. I'd always urged George to put this in the bank so he would not be robbed, but he liked the money in his pocket. The farmhouse on Little Flint Creek between Gentry and Siloam Springs was where the family obtained many of their first conveniences. First telephone was obtained in 1930 or 1931, and the number was 23. Two long rings and three short rings. That's a party line. I remember party line as a kid at my grandma's. This number was for the rural line, and there was up to eight others on the same line. The central, or operator, was in Gentry, and the number from town was 814-F23. BR-54, not no. The F stood for farm number. Electricity was first brought into the house in the late 1940s. Before electricity arrived, they had a gasoline generator, which they only started at nights for the lights. With the generator in place, they purchased a hot water heater and a wringer washer. While the generator ran at night, they did the laundry so the generator wouldn't have to run in the daylight hours. The days of heating water and kettle, boiling clothes and lye soap, and scrubbing with a washboard were past. But rinsing in a separate tub remains the same with those early wringer washers. I got my finger caught in a wringer when I was a kid. The family's first car was purchased by Irvy in 1931 or 32. It was a 1922 or 23 Model T. He paid $10 and 20 bushels of corn valued at 50 cents a bushel. And the Model T had gravity-fed fuel, so they had to back up hills to keep the engine from dying because there was not enough money to keep the gas tank full. Later, Irvy and George bought a Model A for $75. Gas was 9 to 12 cents a gallon. George was very kind and helped many people that came into his life. He would often say, "Heidi, put another plate on the table tonight." Heidi would then serve not only the family, but the guests that George had found. Everyone was welcome, except those that had been drinking. Even from family members, they come to realize that they must be sober to be welcome at George's house. One of George's brothers came to the house drunk, and George told him to leave. He left reluctantly and threatened to come back and kill George. He never did. The years were good to them, notwithstanding hardship. Drought plagued the land from 1930 to 36, and the farm situated in the valley was not hit so hard as some areas. I wonder if this is the time that the blight went through. There used to be, where my family's from in Hiawassee, orchards there, pears and apples and peaches, cannon factory there. But it all came wiped out, and this might be about the same timeline. Well, let's see. Let's continue here. The farm situated in the valley was not hit so hard as some places. The creek kept flowing, and the springs didn't dry up. But the land that usually grew gardens without irrigation became dusty and grew very little. The family used spring water to help the plants along. This drought was felt all over the nation and was much worse in other areas. Nearby states were turned into the Dust Bowl, which contributed to the Great Depression. But the water kept flowing on Little Flint Creek, and the springs continued to bring them life-giving water. And the family thanked God for leading George to have purchased this haven, flowing with water and life-giving food just before the drought and depression began. Irvy remembers that George was injured while loading ties in Goodman. Goodman, Missouri, owned the Kansas City Railroad in 1935 or 36. The boxcar was almost filled with ties as George walked up the gangplank with a tie on his shoulder. While turning the tie to a 45-degree angle, the front end of it bumped into one of the loaded ties and George was knocked off balance. His head was crushed up against the boxcar door by the tie, skinning a large portion of his head. George had the presence of mind. I wonder if he had the kerosene. Had the presence of mind to hang on and was thus kept from falling. Irvy, who saw the whole thing happen, thought his father was dead. However, George was taken to the hospital in Neosho. I got Pruitt's side of the family up at that part of the world, Neosho, Missouri, for treatment and recuperation. Excuse me. Pardon. Fortunately, the doctor was able to place the skin back, and in the process of time, George was back to normal. I got a burp in there, pardon me. Mr. McGee decided that George was now an insurance risk. Oh, and didn't let him return to work. Huh. That ended his 25-year career of tie loading for Mr. McGee. He had loaded ties for National Tie and Timber Company on the Missouri and North Arkansas for about 19 years and then loaded ties for Coopers Incorporated on the Kansas City Southern for the next 6 years until his accident. George said no one ever outworked him in tie loading, even though they tried. He had loaded so many ties that he had a notch worn on the bone of his shoulder that remained there all his life. Dora remembers that the Barnett family had always believed in God and been associated with the Baptist Church. However, in the summer of 1934, a neighbor, Mr. Pinckney, started coming by the house every Sunday and giving a religious lecture to the family, or giving religious literature to the family. I bet this is going to be Seventh-day Adventist. It's the big headquarters up around there of the Seventh-day Adventist Church and camp up there. Anyways, let's just see. He is coming to the house every Sunday giving religious literature to the family. The literature was called, there it is, Signs of the Times and Present Truth. I think that's Seventh-day Adventist. Mr. Pinckney stuttered, but seemed to be a wholesome person. He lived close by and leased some of the Barnett land to grow corn. He also worked for George on the farm. Some in the neighborhood warned that the man was a heretic because, yeah, he was a Seventh-day Adventist and went to church on Saturday. Doyle began to read the literature, and George, who could not read, asked Doyle to read the literature to him, which he did. Doyle was perplexed about the teachings, and every night he went to the outhouse. He was perplexed about the teachings, and every night he went to the outhouse, a private place, that's why, he thought, to pray for directions, for direction. Years later, he'd learned that others went to the outhouse for another reason and could not hear him earnestly praying while they waited. Oh, they could hear him earnestly praying while they waited and thought it best not to disturb him. Doyle walked about 3 miles on Saturday to attend church where Mr. Pinckney was attending. Dora and Idy began to conspire to keep him away from church, not having his clothes ready to go on Saturday morning. Doyle went ahead saying he would iron his own shirt and go to church anyway. When Dora realized the plot would not work, she agreed to iron Doyle's shirt. One day, while at the spring, Mr. Pinckney invited Doyle to be baptized, and Doyle decided it was time to make a commitment. He was baptized in Flint Creek in March of 1936, when it was still cold. About a year later, Dora also decided to be baptized, and George agreed that he was ready for that step. Ida said, and I think we call her Idy too. That's why I've been mispronouncing, calling me Idy, we remember. Now, Idy said that she was not convinced that she should be baptized. On May the 15th of 1937, the morning of the baptism, the minister, Isaac Baker, called the candidates forward. To everyone's surprise, Idy came with them. All three were baptized down in Flint Creek and that day and joined the Seventh-day Adventist Church. The following year, Idy's mother, Nancy Lee Lowrance, was also baptized. I was baptized in the Seventh-day Adventist Church here in Clinton. The other children of the family began to get jobs, marry, and move away from home. Iva married in 1939. Irvy married in 1934 and was drafted in 1942. He left for England in 1943. Dora came and went to school and various jobs after Newton died. In 1942, she married again in California, and after that, returned only for family reunions and infrequent visits. Doyle left for college in 1937 and then married in 1940, soon after, left as a missionary to China. Family reunions offered centered on his return on furlough. Ray married in 1940 and went to California for a while, then was drafted in 1944. He was sent to the Pacific to defend his country. When he returned to the States, he held positions in different areas. Lots of pictures here. We're skipping pictures. This will be really good to get up onto the internet. We're moving far ahead. Lots of pictures. Head to page 52. And we are 2 minutes and five. It's probably going to make closer to 3 hours, I reckon. Maybe. Let's see where we end up. Okay. At the page, top of page 52. Since Ida and George milked cows, they had all the milk and cream they needed. There was always an abundance of butter, buttermilk, and cottage cheese. Ida had a lovely oblong butter mold with a flower on it that she used to mold her homemade butter. To provide herself with some money, Ida began storing her lovely molded surplus butter in the spring house and quietly selling this and her extra eggs in town. She would hide the egg and butter money under the linoleum in the kitchen and other places. One day a delivery truck drove up outside and George asked what they were doing at the house. Ida advised him to wait and see. Then he saw they were delivering a piano. He said, "I haven't ordered a piano." "No, I did," Ida answered. George had not allowed the other children to take piano lessons, saying that it was not going to help them get a better job. So Ida had saved her money for the twins to have piano lessons, and the piano was delivered. With time, George had a change of heart and began to take an interest in music, and he also proudly encouraged the twins to practice the piano. There was a long row of strawberries at the edge of the field. Excuse me a second. Had an itch on my back. Where are we at with them strawberries? Yep, there was a long row at the edge of the field, and when they were ripe, Geneva and Jeanette would pick them and sell them by the crate. Blackberries were also picked and sold by the crate. Sometimes the little Flint Creek overflowed its bank and flooded the farmland. One time the cows were stranded on the other side of the creek when the floodwaters came, so they had to go around the road about 10 miles to get to the cows to milk them. They had a 10-gallon milk can of fresh milk, but dropped the whole thing when trying to get it back to the house. Another time, the creek was rising so rapidly, they decided it was time to evacuate. The water was rising about an inch a minute, creeping up the porch. They started to leave, but they hadn't gotten far away when Ida said, "I think the water is beginning to go down now." So they returned home. Yet another time, the girls and Ida were down by the creek. A noise was heard, and a wall of water a couple of feet high was coming down the creek towards them. A quick yell alerted everyone to get out of the way to safety. Geneva lost one of her shoes in the flash flood. She never saw it again, though they didn't hunt for it. Ida and George decided that Jeanette and Geneva should attend a Christian school instead of a gentry public school. And in the fifth grade, they began attending the Ozark Academy Elementary School, a Seventh-day Adventist school near their home. Geneva and Jeanette walked the 3.5 miles to school many times because Ida and George had but one car. Usually the girls would be taken to school and they'd walk home. Geneva and Jeanette were very well dressed with tailor-made dresses made from nice print feed sacks. Ida was an extremely good seamstress and tailor. I had learned to drive and went to work at John Brown University as a cook in the cafeteria. Excuse me. To help pay for the tuition and for the twins. She kept this position for several years. This income enabled them to send Geneva and Jeanette to Union College. At the university cafeteria, Idy baked and made the desserts. She made sweet rolls from scratch and topped them with a thickened pineapple that was a hit with the students. Her pies were absolutely scrumptious. When she was not there, the students were terribly disappointed. By the time the only Barnett children still living at home were Jeanette and Geneva, they each had their own room upstairs with dressing tables and porcelain figurines. Leola May and Idy. Let me skip ahead and I'll pass some pictures. Boy, you can tell them are Barnetts. Sure, looking at them. This is a Barnett family portrait taken in 1938. There's strong characteristics of the Barnett family. You can tell they're Barnett when you look at them, for sure. I can sure see that how they, the ones alive today, looking like their ancestors. Okay, so then Denise recalls, this is the top of page 55, recalls, I thought they were rich and oh, so grown up. I remember the generators and its crankiness, the creek in the outhouse overhanging the creek, and I remember Aunt Idy's homemade ice cream and chocolate cake with chocolate frosting. I remember the spring and the crocks of milk cooling there, and the piano in the parlor, and the time when they were just starting in the chicken business. They had dozens of baby chickens in boxes in the parlor, and maybe because of the weather, I'm not sure. Anyways, by the next morning, those little chickens had flown the coop. And wherever were. There's an old I Love Lucy episode similar to that. And I always think of Aunt Idy and Uncle George when I see that rerun. Everyone was running around trying to put chickens back in their boxes. Betty Jo, that's Ivy's daughter, recalls that Granddad would step on the heads of baby chicks to kill them. So that one day she copied him. And that was when she learned that Granddad would step only on the sick ones. Betty Jo had not been selective in which one she had stepped on. Betty Jo also recalls that when she was not a gardener, and it seemed like Granddad thought that she was lazy. But one day that changed. Granddad had a very young cow that had just calved for the first time, and the cow did not let her new calf nurse, and the cow would surely die if it did not get milk. So Granddad was trying to persuade this new young mother cow to do its thing. Granddad did everything he knew, including whipping the cow, but it still was not successful. Finally, he roped the cow and drew the rope around a light pole near the barn and fence, and he gave the end of the rope to Betty Jo and said, "Here, you hold this." So she did. But the cow was struggling to get away and pushed Betty Jo up against the fence. Granddad got the cow away from Betty Jo and got the calf to nurse its mother. Then he asked Betty Jo if she had been frightened. She says no. As they walked into the house together, George called out and said, "Idy, Betty Jo may be worth something yet." Years later, in 1945, George got tick fever. He was ill for quite a period of time and suffered some of the ill effects of this fever for the rest of his life. George began to have heart problems in 1947 and had pain in his chest off and on until he died 20 years later. In 1960, Cap and Flurry Bruscom, George's half-sister, were visiting George and Idy from Oregon. George took them on a little trip just south of Taneytown. That's all back around where my family's from. Just south of Taneytown, George lost control of the car. Cap Branscombe died in the crash. Idy was seriously injured and hospitalized and was in traction 4 months. She was told she'd never walk again, but her constant perseverance got her up and walking again. George blamed himself for the death of Cap and felt the loss deeply. As a direct result of the terrible accident, George had a public auction on the farm August the 31st in 1962. He sold 19 head of cattle, all the farm equipment, many household goods, and other miscellaneous items too numerous to mention. He and Mighty moved into Siloam Springs on Mount Olive Street. Idy was still in the hospital when the sale of the farm occurred. She never got to go back to the farm and was sad about some of the pieces of furniture which she had to part. George missed the farm tremendously, but he did continue farming almost daily by working with Irby and his former neighbor, Achill Hardcastle. 57. It didn't take long after George and Idy's move away from the farm for the place to deteriorate. A young family moved into the farm and were not diligent in keeping it up. Betty Jo recalls a visit to the farm a few years later, a few years after the sale, and found it almost deteriorating before her eyes. Despite his aging years, George's hair did not turn gray. Maybe this was due to his Native American genes. He never liked the easy life in town. He spent some time studying words so he could read a few sentences in books. He busied himself helping Irby keeping his Dairyette parking lot clean after closing. That's like a Dairy Queen, reckon. We had a Dairy Freeze for the Dairy Queen. I can't remember there in Hiawassee. So I think it's still there to this day. But anyway, so he had a garden and he helped his friends on their farm. On their farms, and he always dreamed of going back to his farm, but that dream was never realized. After returning from his field on October the 30th, 1966, at the age of 81, George died of a heart attack. Ida lived 22 more years after George died until February the 16th, 1988. George had purchased another house at 707 South Wright Street in Siloam Springs, and Idy moved there after George died. She lived alone for 19 years or so, and in 1985 she had a hallucination so severe that Ray and Irby felt it best to put her in a nursing home in Siloam Springs. However, at a family reunion, she and some of her children decided that it would be good for her to live with Dora in Vancouver, Washington. Idy seemed very happy. About a year later, she broke her hip and had to live in a nursing home in Vancouver until her death. Dora kept constant watch over her at the nursing home up to 8 hours per day. Then Idy had a stroke and in the end died of pneumonia. Her body was returned to Arkansas for the funeral. Betty Jo Rose recalls learning something about her grandmother at the funeral service. Betty Jo always thought she was a special grandchild, but at the funeral service she learned that she was not the only one who thought this. All of the grandchildren said that they felt unique and loved by their grandmother. Idy had a great capacity for making each person feel special. Boy, that's touching. Sure. Idy was laid to rest beside her beloved husband in the Gentry Cemetery. They both died, believing death is as a sleep from which Jesus will awaken them to eternal life when he returns. So they rest on a gentle slope surrounded by farmland and the new suburban developments on the plateau of the Ozarks. The train rumbles by frequently and family members come with flowers every decoration day. They're at rest but not forgotten. The old farm on Little Flint Creek, along with all the property in the valley, is presently covered by a lake. A power company, SWEPCO, Southwestern Electrical Power Company, purchased the valley in the early 1970s. They built a dam on Little Flint Creek, filling the valley and covering the farmland. The lake water is used to supply and cool the coal-fired electrical plant, so swimming in SWEPCO Lake is taking a warm bath. We've got sources. Dora Barnett, Ray Barnett, Jeanette Barnett, Doyle Barnett, email from Leola Mae McFarlane Page, who interviewed Ola Lowrance McFarlane. History of Benton County, Arkansas, 1991. LB, Arkansas, from the history of the area by Arthur and Haley Orman, edited by E. Ryman. Railroads of North Arkansas by R.G. Wynn. Short Lines, Railroads of Arkansas. Taped interview of Idy Barnett on January the 2nd, 1979, with Ray and Mark doing the interview. Betty Jo Holland Rose. 59, we have a tribute to our parents. Jeanette comments about her parents. Our parents' principles were but a reflection of the scriptures. Did they know this? Probably not. These principles were the gleanings of proper home standards. You're scratching a living from the sod of Arkansas and raising 7 children on 1 income. The teaching methods were not perfect, but we knew that we were loved. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. Ecclesiastes 9:10. And greater love hath none, has no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friends. John 15:13. Did they know these verses? Probably not. But they were as surely a part of them as overalls and smocks on the farm. As parents, they were not perfect, but they did the best of what they had. Ray comments about his parents' background of Idy Jane Lowrance Barnett by third son Ray J. Barnett. Mother was the son of 7 children, all girls. She was raised in a 2-room wooden house on a homestead farm near a little town named Elby, Arkansas, which is non-existent today. The kitchen in her home was an add-on to the main room, which consisted of a wooden stove. The stove is a wood stove. In the middle of the room, 3 beds in respective corners of that room, a spinning wheel in the other corner, and a sewing machine and stand table adjoining. The room had 1 window and a front door leading to the front porch. The kitchen had a wooden cook stove, cabinet, table, some chairs, a bench, a table, and a hutch to keep chinaware. There was a window in each end. The family of 9 lived in the house at the time of her marriage, age 14. Mother became the outside farm helper to the light of her dad, John Lowrance. She matured early in life and became strong. She helped her dad cut wood and haul it to the house. She helped plow, plant, cultivate, and harvest crops. She also learned to cook early in life and at times had to get up early and build fires and cook breakfast. Somehow she loved life and found time to play with her sisters and some homemade dolls. Mother loved her family dearly. She had her first five children by the age of 23. 14 years later, she had 20 girls. They were educated at Ozark Academy School and graduated in 1951. Later in life, she told us that inasmuch as she was still playing with dolls when she was married, when her grandchildren came so early in life, she thought she had several live dolls and loved and played with them accordingly. She was raised in a day in an era when there was little educational opopportunities, at the most 3 to 6 months of school a year. She completed the 3rd grade, but continued to learn all the days of her life and loved learning. Obviously, she had no lessons in child rearing, but undoubtedly, by divine intuition, she knew more about child rearing than many of the highly trained experts of today. She taught more by doing than by theory, and being than by instruction. Her word was her contract, and her children soon. Her word was her contract, and her children soon learned that she meant business and began responding accordingly. She knew where the switches were and that the Lord had made a lot of them for a different purpose. After the switch was in hand, she knew how to use it effectively. Her children also knew that she knew those things and gradually developed great. Turning pages. Lots of pictures here. Lots of pictures here. Turning pages. We're almost at the end here. I believe I got one more page to read. Page and a half. Wow, I'll be close to 2.5 hours. That'll be good. Okay, that'll be all of chapter one. Okay, in respect for her knowledge and the application of that knowledge. It didn't do any good for any of the children to run from her, for she was fast and swift, and running from her only increased the severity of that chastisement. Away, we children tested her determination, and we always found it out the hard way. It kept ever wandering children from going too far astray and kept them under surveillance at the most needed time of their lives. Our dad stubbornly insisted that we children perform assigned responsibilities and that we fulfill their words with corresponding action. The result? The children love them dearly and love the Lord and His kingdom dearly. Therefore, she and dad will forever live in their children's memory. In conclusion, although our parents had a meager education, they had a sense of purpose and values in life. They made a lasting impression on their children. Work if you want to eat. Honesty is the best policy. Submission to authority, otherwise discipline. A time to work, a time to play. The Bible is God's word. Their love was genuine. Geneva comments about her parents. My memory of my mother was she was young at heart and literally grew up with her children. She was ahead of her generation by setting goals for herself and her children, and she went after her goals and ideas to achieve them. She was so very creative and had an extraordinary outlook on life and was always positive. She taught herself to sew on an old treadmill sewing machine, making clothes from the skin out. She cut clothing patterns from newspaper and fitted them to each individual. I remember a beautiful purple wool coat she had tailor-made for Jeanette and me. She was a creative cook. Dad invited people as guests, either from church or friends who had just dropped in for a visit for dinner, and Mother was always prepared, or could cook up a meal real fast. She was a comedian and looked at the comic side of life. She chose her words carefully. She was independent, even more so after we twins were born. She behaved like the liberated woman of today and easily could have belonged to today's generation. I said easily. My dad was very honest and friendly and very hardworking. He taught me to be honest, never tell a lie, and always look and look everyone you talk to in the eye. He was a devout Christian and loved to share the teachings of the Bible with everyone he met. He didn't have much education, but was no wallflower. He taught me to always be positive and have great self-esteem. Dad and Mom had 5 children, then 14 years later, twin girls arrived. Dad wanted another boy, but soon utilized the girls as they grew up into the garden and fields. He always planted a huge garden that would have fed 15 people, plus food for canning and freezing for the rest of the winter. He would plant what seemed like an acre or half acre for his garden, a half acre of sweet potatoes and a half acre of Irish potatoes, and then raise hay and corn for horses and cows. He raised 5,000 chickens at a time for a feed store. Dad taught me never give up. Continue with a project or a job until it was complete, and then would never have to worry. One would never have to worry about it. Work, work, work. No time to play, relaxing, only to visit with family and friends. Dad went swimming with us often. Mom had too many chores. Once I lost my shoe swimming with Doris, Jean, and Jeanette, who started screaming. Dad ran down to the creek and jumped in and said, "Where is she?" A tribute to my dad by Dora Barnett Stevenson, November 1966. This valiant heart that beats so many years and rhythms of faithful kindliness He left us, but through the tears we smile to know He has release from pain and is at peace. And for the precious memories of a fine spirit and true, we say unto the love divine, dear Lord, we thank You for a dad that was so true. That ends chapter 1. And when I come back, we'll go to chapter 2 of Elby, Then and Now. Thanks to... this is going to be a continuing project, so I hope you'll come back for more. And this is from my friend Kevin, a good friend, and his family here on Half Moon Mountain in the Ozarks of Arkansas. And we'll see you on the next one. Thanks.